et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, that's really the main reason why they do it. Some people just are getting out of it and, you know, they've got lots of money. They want to go into real estate or something else, but it's relatively passive work. You know, it's a, you know, payroll and FedEx does all the logistics.
Just curious, before we get started, what's the big challenges with that type of business? Is it drivers? Is it accidents? Is it insurance? I really haven't looked at the P&L to that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like any transport business, your big issue is twofold. Your trucks, right? And so the age of the trucks will determine also to a certain extent how much you're paying for your business, because you're paying for the routes, which, you know, don't depreciate. You know, they grow as an asset, but the trucks are depreciating. And so where are you in the life cycle of the truck? That's one thing. The other thing, of course, is growing fuel costs. That's an issue. That's a higher expense. So you got to know what to do about that.
It's almost $7 in California.
Yeah, well, less than that in Boston, Massachusetts. But yeah, it's an issue all over the place. And then, of course, you know, long term, we're moving towards probably driverless trucks, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years. But it's not something to worry about right now. There's actually an enormous amount of infrastructure work that needs to be put into place for that to work, right? So, you know, we're not worried about that in the short run. But the real issue is, to tell you the honest truth, is the recruitment and retention of drivers.
There's always a challenge.
But I'm not worried about that, because we pay a little bit better than normal, and so retention is not hard. And line haul keeps people very, very nicely, because it's really simple work. You get in the truck, you drive it, you hook up the trailer, you drive it, you unhook the trailer, and that's it. You go always from one place to another place the same every day. So it's really a great industry to roll up, because that's what we're doing, is we're going to roll it up and then, you know, professionalize it a little bit. One of the best things to do with it, of course, is we have a mobile mechanic, but even better is to get leases with Ryder. And then that way, if your truck ever breaks down on the road, they're responsible for that. They bring in another truck, haul the trailer off, they fix your tractor, and you pay, you know, a little bit more money, but you've now taken a variable and you've made it into a fixed cost.
Yeah.
And so that's necessary if you're going to sell these things off to a PE firm later on. So, you know, but wonderful opportunity, wonderful industry.
Bernie, nice to have you here. Let me jump into this, because we're 6 minutes in, but David Ray is one of my students. Mag, how you doing? Pedro, Darwin, Mr. BG Bet, not sure who that is, and Marlon. I know everybody here. Yeah. And Jude. So, David, thanks for. I just want to mention something to David. I just sent Tyler another message to say, hey, can you shit or get off the pot?
Yeah, so, I saw it.
Yeah. All right. So, I'm not going to do a PowerPoint presentation, because I'm notoriously bad at reading those things and going at like hummingbird speed too fast. So here's what we're just going to talk about today is, you know, using buying a business and raising capital from outside investors. So everybody here, if this makes any sense to anybody, and if it's going to be applicable to anybody, is that you need to have a great deal ready to go. Well, you know, what is a great deal? We talked about that in the email, but a great deal is a enduringly profitable business, low debt, you know, good operations, good executions, debt service coverage ratio 1.5 or greater. It's been around for 5 to 10 years. As you know, 5 years is nice. 10 years is better. Usually means it's going to last a lot longer. It minimizes risk. There's a process in place to acquire customers, meaning if I put a dollar in here, whether it's SEO, whether it's trade shows, whether it's PPC, I get $2, $3, $4, $5, $6 back. Not every business is like that. We just talked to Birdie, who's got his customers right from FedEx, so he doesn't need that kind of stuff. You know, and that's the same thing with if I build an application and put it on Apple, you know, the Apple app, you know, Apple brings everything to them. So a business has to have really good profits, enduringly profitable, good process in place, low debt, and a reasonable valuation, meaning fair market value, right? I'm not going to be able to raise any money for anything that's a 3x that sold comps all around the country at 3x, and you get to buy it, or you gave somebody an LOI for 5x. Anybody can do that. You know, I can go to any store in the business, any biz buy sell local business, and say, hey, that's a really cool accounting firm. I'll give you 10x for it. That's an exaggeration, but it's not going to be, you can't raise money on that. So that's the first thing. You got to have a great deal in place, right? And you're probably going to use a little bit of seller financing. You could be using bank debt. That's a little bit in danger right now. If we go under government shutdown, there's not going to be any SBA loans written. Little owner's equity, they get to keep it. You're kind of doing the private equity model. And most of the times, most people are, they got to come with a down payment. It's $100,000, $700,000, right? That's kind of what the structure usually looks at on all these small to medium-sized businesses. Let's say you get that LOI in place, but the next thing you need is a operator, right? You've got to have the expertise and the skill to run that business. And I'm referring, the reason I'm bringing this up is because investors are going to require it. They're going to look at you and go, are you a good steward of my money? If you're a 20-year-old trying to buy an HVC company from a guy retiring who's run it for 30 years, that is a high risk. They may give you the money, but it's still going to be a very, very high risk. But if you're a peer that owned an HVAC company for 10 years and were in the HVAC industry for 30 years, that is going to minimize the risk for the investor. So that's another checkbox. So the last thing is you're going to need help raising the money. And that money, that down payment could look like $50,000, could look like $700,000. And you're either going to do it for one or two ways, friends or family, or be outside investors. Now, most, if you have friends and family with a lot of money, fantastic, right? Go to them first. Work on your pitch with them first. If you don't, you got to go to the outside investors. Let me ask a question. Has anybody raised capital before with outside investors? Bertie has, David has. David is in real estate, does real estate deals. So he knows the process. So these outside investors, I should eliminate this. You're probably here because you don't have friends and family that can put up a couple $100,000 or $700,000. Is that right?
Yep.
All right. So then we want to ask, how do we find these outside investors? Well, in the United States today, they're all over the place, right? They're on social media. They're on Facebook. They're on Twitter. They're on LinkedIn. They're on search funding. But how do you get to them, right? How do you find out about them and how do you approach them? Well, all of this is to a first-time entrepreneur, it's going to be a learning experience. You're going to have the good deal, you're going to be a great operator, and then you're going to have to put some materials in place, which is like a deck, bullet points which are the bait, which you send out first to investors. Say, hey, I got a business, it's doing 3 million top line, let's say 500,000 bottom line. I got a great price on this. I'm going to do a little owner's equity. I'm going to do some seller financing. and I'm gonna do a little bit of bank loan, but I need $300,000 down payment. I'm a self-funded searcher seeking $300,000 for an acquisition under LOI. Then you send out this information to all of these potential investors to see if they bite. It's like fishing, right? You throw a lot of lines out, and do they bite? Do they have any interest in it? And then they're going to go, yeah, I'm interested. And then they're going to, then you're going to send them a pitch deck. I don't really put people under NDA, especially investors, because they don't really, they're not going to really buy a FedEx route business if they're, you know, in Texas and you're trying to do it in Maine. I'm not going to put them under NDA. I just send the deck. And the deck is going to include a lot of things, right? What you're doing, what you're seeking, the financial report cards, a snapshot, a balance sheet, your future story, KPI and metrics, and about you, which is who you are. This is a movie trailer that kind of gets them more and more interested. And then you go and send, if they want more information after that, then you're going to have to get on the phone with a Zoom and explain it, because they're always going to have questions. Always. They will have unique interests because somebody may be a real estate investor. Somebody may be a doctor. Somebody may be an ex-Facebook engineer who made a lot of money going public. And they're all going to have these different risk tolerances. So the key to this is, and I'm not going to be ashamed about telling you this, is Dave and I have done this before, and it requires a big list. It requires access to a lot of high net worth individuals. This is something I've been cultivating for the last 10, 15 years. I don't know if you guys know this, but I was involved in the startup industry. We built this company called Turbo Squid, raised some money. Many, many years later, it was sold to Shutterstock. Then I raised some money through some crowdfunding, Reg D's, CFs, and Reg A's, and some publicly traded companies. And we've raised right now, I'm doing some raises for some acquisition entrepreneurs for that down payment. So I built this list of high net worth individuals through my podcast, through my LinkedIn, which is 20,000, with my email list over 6,000. And then we send these deals out to them to see if they're interested in the deal. That's why I built up this social media following, to be part of this. So this is, raising money is not easy. It's hard. David will attest to that. David Ray will. It takes a lot of energy to send out a lot of casting a wide net. You're getting the information back. You send more information to them. And then you have to put them through this process of, hey, we're closing this opportunity in 90 days because of the LOI. Are you interested in more information, or are you out of the deal, or are you interested in the deal? And what level are you interested in the deal? Can you put in 100,000, or can you put in 25?
Hey, John.
Yeah.
Whenever you, let's say you put the terms together and you send it to the broker, and the broker and the sellers accept it.
Are you referring to the LOI first?
Huh?
Are you referring to the LOI, or are you referring?
Yeah. And then they accept it, right? So the clocks start ticking after they accept it, and you gotta find an investor in 90 days, right?
Yeah.
To put down the down payment.
Yes.
If you don't find the investor in 90 days, do you pay any penalties, or is just it's void?
Yeah, it's just a void contract. I mean, it's a void LOI.
So it's not like real estate that you lose a down payment or anything like that.
Yeah, well, David could actually talk more about that. I'm not a real estate agent, but in the world of acquisitions, you put an LOI down and you couldn't raise the money. It expires. there's no breakup contract with acquisition entrepreneurs where you're required to pay it if you don't raise the money.
Oh, that's good. So after the 90 days, you just tell the broker, hey, listen, unfortunately, yeah, look, they couldn't.
What you want to try to do is let them know what's happening, that, you know, you're making progress during this raise. You're 50% of the goal or 80% of the goal. But if you don't reach it, you know, keep in front of them and ask them, would you be interested in renegotiating with this? I'm making a genuine effort here to do this. Would you be interested in making up any?
Right.
Yeah.
I know some brokers do ask for a deposit, but I mean, it's negotiable. You can either get one or not. I mean, it all depends on the broker and how much, you know, how you come across. So.
Okay.
I would say it's all about your story and about communication is your biggest. That's your biggest thing you've got to do in the deal. So if you're communicating from start to finish what your intentions are, one of the things that we do when we're looking at a deal, whether it's real estate or the business side, we give the broker as well as the potential seller a checklist of what we're planning to do in that process within that 90 days. But we also already have investors that we have lined up behind the scenes before we even get to the deal, saying, listen, we're in the process of acquiring a deal. Here's the criteria that we're using. Based upon that, is that something that sounds like would be of interest to you? If so, would you be open for me to send deals to you as they come through? We're going to pre-vet the deal in advance to try to do a lot of the hard work for you. But then we know you're going to take it to your accountants, your people to vet the deal as well. But just know when we bring you the deal, it's already been vetted where we feel like this is a doable deal. The multiple's right. The deal is solid. This is a good 10-year-old plus business. You know, the employees are solid. You know, the average employee's been there 5-10 years. So we feel like there's a lot of solid reasons to proceed with this deal because we're not interested in wasting time. But yeah. Back to your question, it's really about communication.
Yeah, transparency, right?
Yep.
If you're honest with them about, look, this, we have to syndicate this deal, meaning you're going to go out and talk to, you don't have the money, you're not a fund, you're not wealthy, you're going to have to go out and ask a number of people to help you raise the capital. And that could be high net worth individuals, could be brokers, could be, you know, a site, could be a different number of different things.
Gotcha.
Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Look, this is raising capital is not an easy venture, right? And it's a skill that, you know, David and I have been working on for the last 20 years just because we had to, just pragmatically. But if you're trying to buy a business, my suggestion is find somebody that's done it before to help you through that process. But you need a good deal. You got to be an operator, and then go get the money.
Hi, John.
Hey.
Hi. Hi. I have a kind of a follow-on question. Just by way of background, my name is Amjeet. I'm kind of been lurking in the background in this new search area. I recently exited a company that I started 3 months ago. My question is around, it says, it's kind of piggybacking on some of the stuff you guys have already been talking about. And I feel like I'm hearing sort of the answer, but the question really is like, if I want to see a deal that's maybe bigger than I can financially support, or that I, you know, if I don't want to show a P&L to a broker, how do you see these larger deals? Or is just that I don't go the broker route and I really try to do a more proprietary search? The question really is around, how do you get to see some of these deals if you don't already have the financing secured?
Oh, David's going to laugh at this, but you're going to encounter this with a number of the sites of the larger deals. They're going to ask for proof of funds, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a number of ways to answer that. Just say, hey, we're a holding company. We have a syndication. We're going to go out here and raise capital of this. We don't have a fund to purchase. So, you know, that may work. Some of them will just sign the NDA. David's used a lot of kind of tricks to just say, hey, we are private investors, you know, we go to, we're like a private equity fund, just mm-hmm. let us go, because that's usually the case, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have you want to go bigger, lower middle market, $10 million. And you know, they're gonna, a lot of those deals go for 50% down. And which means you're gonna have to come up with $5 million. And that's, yeah, you know, most people don't have $5 million ready to go. So you're going to have to go out to family offices, private equity, or high net worth individuals.
Right.
And you just tell that story to the broker.
Right. That makes sense. Does it work? Has it worked for anybody? Has anybody?
Yeah. I mean, you and I are partnering on a number of deals. Yeah.
Do it every day.
I just asked this. I've been sending emails to John and then just had the problem. And I talked to a bunch of brokers, and as a matter of fact, I got like three brokers, you know, that I'm talking to, and I answer the same questions, you know, basically the same. When they ask proof of funds, I'm like, yeah, I'm a partner of acquisitions holding syndication, like John told me to, and it works.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you guys. Sorry, I think that was kind of off topic.
No worries. So I'm going to continue open to the questions, but what I want to do is also say, look, I'm going to make myself available to help you raise capital for these acquisitions. I did a trial run with another acquisition entrepreneur who put an LOI down on a $2 million HVAC company, did quite a bit of seller financing, owner kept a little bit of equity, but he needed $700K. I went out to my network, 20,000 LinkedIn followers, search funders, and everybody that's on my list from the podcast, and a couple other groups I know. And he's busy. He's probably got three or four offers to commit. Nothing in the bank yet, but there's a lot of interest. This is what I want to provide a service to you if you're at that spot. And then at this point, I'm going to show you something. All right. David, you want to share any experience of how we do this?
On which part? On the initial call with the brokers? You want me to deal with that? On how to deal with proof of funds?
Yeah, no, we. I think it's got the. How do you pronounce your name? Oh, she left.
No.
All right. So if you go to my site, it's dealflowsystem.net. How to raise capital for acquisitions. There's a couple of ways you can go this. If you buy the course that I've outlined above, which is the entire process, creating a goals, your watch, your map, and your compass. By the way, that's from David Ray. And then I give you a sample of introduction to raising capital. Dominic Wells, I helped him raise capital, $13 million for us to go public. Created a fundraising strategy, equity fund for structures for SMBs. How to get in front of syndications, private equity, family office, high net worth individuals, and the legal documents required. If you just buy the course only, comes with the 60 minutes one-on-one consulting. It's $9.97. If you want the service done for you, with you, I'm going to work with you for 3 months. We're going to create the pitch deck. We're going to help you design the bait, which is the bullet points that you send out to see if there's initial interest. We're going to continually working on this living document, which is your pitch deck, adding the financial models, due diligence support, getting your back room ready to go, show you how to pitch to these investors. And then we'll start doing the cold outreach to everybody. And then they're going to always have some critiques or questions. And then we'll adjust the pitch again, and then you go back to them, and then we'll help you close. I do this for 3 months. It's $3,500 for if you got a good deal and you're ready to go to raise capital. So everybody see that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay, great. And I'm going to put this in the chat. And if you have questions afterwards, just, you know, get ready to ask questions. A lot of this stuff happens within Do you offer this for equity fund building pre-LOI? Yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, as David said, he was talking about a model. Like the first time you do it, everything's new, difficult, and unknown. But once you start doing it and building this connection with investors, you open them up to say, hey, if there's a deal for this, would you be interested, right? The more people are not going to invest in you if they, unless they know you, trust you, like you, before they invest in you. Is the course included in the coaching? Yes, Bertie, it is. So you can it's a lifetime unlimited guarantee on that. All right, so everybody has that. I'm going to just open up to questions because I know everybody's got questions about raising capital. All right, who's got it? Pedro, Ash, when you, Cody, Marlon.
Bernie. When you going to, especially when you're going to new people and they ask you, how much are you, before I give you money, how much are you putting in? Do you get that question?
Yeah, a little bit, but if you look at this as a professional, self-funded sponsor, just you'd be honest. Like, hey, I'm not putting any money in. I found the deal. I've got the LOI at a reasonable valuation, and here, all I need is $700,000. Here's what they're probably going to ask for. They're going to ask for a little bit of a sweetener on this deal. It's called a step up. And if, you know, you need $700,000, they ask for a little bit of a multiplier. And this came from the venture capital industry. It's a little bit of a multiplier where their dollar is worth a little bit more than your dollar. And if you need to do that to get the deal, do it on the first one. Okay. Does everybody understand what I said there?
Yeah. What do you mean by step up, John?
Well, it's a step up is actually a term used in accounting and taxes. But in the venture capital world, a step up is say, okay, it's actually a multiplier. It means your dollar is worth a dollar, but if I need his money, his dollar is worth $1.50.
Are you talking about a liquidation preference?
It's a little bit like that. Yes. Yes. Yes.
So what's up? When you exit, you're going to give him $1.50.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. And when it comes down to those deals, when you're raising, when you find the deal, you basically the acquisition role, finding, putting everything together, are you going to operate the business too? How are you going to exit this? Or are you just going to transfer some ownership to you towards the end?
Well, he's a minority. Are you talking about minority investors? If he puts in some...
Yeah, well, let's say, for instance, you know, I put the deal together. I found a smoking deal, right? And then I go in and I'll sell it to you, John, because, you know, you and I know. And then you're going to put down the down payment.
Yeah.
Where is my role after that? Like, am I going to be operating or, you know, what's going to happen? Or, you know, I'll tell you, hey, John, you know, I just need a 20% equity on this.
I mean, that's the difference between, you know, kind of silent partner, common shares, preferred shares.
What is the standard, basically, you know, when you go to someone?
Yeah. So for instance, like if Bertie was trying to focus in on this FedEx routes and it's 10 routes, right? Who would be a great advisor or board of directors and potential investor in that business? Somebody that's already owned, you know, 100 FedEx routes.
Right.
Right. That's a great person to have as an investor and on your board of advisors. If it's just money, it's just money, right? They're not going to take a role at all in the company.
Right.
You know, God, how do you pronounce your name? NG?
NG.
Yeah, yep. NG. So, you know, in venture capital world, startup world, like there's smart money and there's dumb money, right? There's just money. Right. Sometimes smart money comes with people on your board of directors that bring the money, and they'll require board of directors and say, I can introduce you to this company, this company, this company, which will help your distribution and help you grow 10x. And then there's just people like, if you're trying to buy a distribution company and you're looking for 700,000, and this guy in Texas is just an investor, it's dollar for dollar.
Yeah. I think from my point of view is I'm looking more from a real estate perspective, because my background was in real estate. So when we find a deal, you know, there's an acquisitions part, and then there's actually people that we can pass the deal to. Either we make a spread or, you know, or something like that. I think David knows what I'm talking about. So from when we find a deal, I'm in the acquisition mode, right? How would I go about, you know, passing this deal through and making a profit, or staying on the deal, staying on the middle and still making a profit? I don't know if David can answer that
too. Yeah, go ahead and answer it. I think
it's in essence a wholesale model. That's one way that you could do it. You could go out and find the deal, bring it to somebody like John and I, for example, and say, hey, listen, I got this fantastic deal. I don't have a network of people to raise money from. Can you assist me with that? I just want to bring you a great deal. Can we work something out? Then from there, we just break it down. What's a fair, probably usually based upon a percentage that we might give you for the deal, or maybe you have some equity in the deal, depending upon what you're bringing to the table. For us, we really build a board is how I've done it. That's experts of whatever industry we're looking to acquire, because that's my credibility. And I don't want to get into the secret sauce too much, but that's one of the ways that we do it is through our board. It's their credibility that's coming to the table. But yes, to your point, if you find a deal, you're acting as a wholesaler and you can bring it to folks like myself or whoever, and we'll help you get the deal. And maybe if you're wanting to be a part of it, every deal is just different, because it depends upon, do you have expertise in that particular area and what can you bring to the table? For example, if you're, let's say we're in medical as an example, and you're trying to acquire a medical based business, do you have medical expertise that you can bring? If you don't, then we have to find the right team to do that. So in that case, it may just be simple, hey, you can make money on the deal. But remember, something of something is better than 100% of nothing.
Right, right.
So yeah, that's where a lot of people get messed up.
Your expectations. If you find a deal, it's an on-market deal through a broker, that's not a lot of value. Right? You're just, oh, okay, just forward the SIM to me. Thank you. Should you get paid for that? Probably not, right?
Well, not if I lock it up. I mean, I've done, you know, go back to the real estate. I've done wholesale deals on market and off market. They both good, you know, depending on the spread. You know, I could make up to 10,000-20,000 on market deal, and it's still a good deal for a flipper when I flip the deal, right, Dave?
Because you had intelligence about the arbitrage opportunity.
What was that? Sorry.
You have the intelligence about
the
You know it's worth more than what they're selling it for.
Exactly.
Right? So if you're buying a business and you have to marshal these resources, allocate these resources a number of different ways, whether it's a down payment, seller financing, and, you know, outside bank lenders, you got to know that's going to be worth more 3 to 5 years down the road.
And how would I know that it's going to be, you know, because I know I have an expectation on real estate of comps. How would I evaluate the business then for, you know, for a flip for me to wholesale to you guys?
This is peers only sell to peers, and 10,000 hours of expertise, right?
Okay.
Like Birdie is going to try to buy some FedEx routes, right?
Yeah.
And I said, what is the biggest challenge in that industry? And he said, finding people. If you figured out how to fix that, the biggest problems in your industry, like the biggest expenses, the biggest challenges, that's the knowledge, right? That you see the arbitrage opportunity.
Right, and there's also a couple of other things as well, I would think. when you look at the micro acquisition world in general, our sweet spot is right there where the The owner is not entirely by himself. He has a bit of a team. He's probably still involved. He has a bit of a team, but he has not yet professionalized, right? He may not have a client acquisition system yet. You might be putting that into place, right? He has proven sales, but he might not have that. He might not have, a number of other things like an operator that can run it from a systems approach. It may be too personality based. There may be three or four things that are key to that industry that you solve. Like in my case, making every truck based on a lease rather than on a mechanic. A mechanic can leave. It may be a little bit cheaper because it depends on the variable of when the truck breaks down and where it breaks down. But if you have a lease, then for the PE firm, thinking about from their point of view, they don't want to deal with a mechanic. They're not there personally dealing with it. They want to have an operator in place. They don't want to think about it too much. A PE firm or family office is probably looking at $2 million EBITDA minimum, and so there's a threshold there as well. So when you roll up a bunch of stuff in an industry that you understand and you professionalize it and put it into a nice package so that the PE firm is happy to buy it, you can then sell it for a higher multiple than what you bought it for, because you've added all this value. And that's how you know that's why we're in this sweet spot. Because if we were actually looking for bigger deals that were already professionalized, we're now competing with the PE firms directly. We don't want to do that. We want to prepare the ground for the PE firms so that they're happy to buy from us. And you got to prepare that too, prepare your relationships with them so that when you're ready to hand it off to them, they're happy to pay top dollar if it's profitable, if it's clean, if the financials are strong, if all of that stuff is in place. Well, that's your big opportunity over 3 to 5 years, professionalize and then sell it off and roll it up. That's what we're going to do with the FedEx up. We're going to roll it up into 20 packages of 25 to 50 delivery routes with a business contact in place and who's a professional who takes care of a particular region. And we can sell it off at a couple of multiples more. And when you multiply that out, that gets to be a number of millions of dollars. It's quite nice.
Yeah, there's a relationship between the risk and the multiple, right? Small businesses are inherently risky. They just don't survive. That makes their multiple smaller. But as soon as you figured out the business model and it's running on its own, it's professional people in place, the risk is minimized and the multiple goes up.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest tricks, and you'll appreciate, especially being in real estate, you'll appreciate this, or it's not really a trick, it's just an understanding that you have to come from the investor private equity perspective on looking at any deal. Put yourself in the banker's shoes, because the bank typically, look, using real estate as a simple example, who puts up the majority of the money? Usually it's 80% will come from the bank or 70%. So who has the most amount of risk? So when you look at deals, look at it from a risk perspective on where is the risk. And to what Bernie said earlier, if you have the proper operators, you have all of that, that's less risky for the bank. Well, the bank in this case is your investors. So you can interchange those names either way. So you have to really start thinking the way a bank does. And if you do, then all of a sudden things start opening up because the investors and the banks are saying, hey, you're looking out for our best interest. Well, all of a sudden that opens up a massive door to you. So anyway, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
All right.
The other thing too to remember, Meg, is that once you bought your first one, especially in the same industry, your credibility goes through the roof, right? So the first one is the hard one. Once you have the first one in place and then you're going back to a lender, you've been successful with your first one, you want to roll up your yourself, you stay in the same industry. And when you do then you have a lot more credibility. It's a lot easier to get the money. And when you do go to these guys and you have no background, let's say you're in real estate and you say, I'm going to go do something with some health business, and you have no clue as to what it is, you don't have no background in it, just makes it much harder to get the money. Because especially if you're going to be the operator. Now, a lot of people are not the operator. They make sure that there's enough spread in their profitability to cover not only the debt financing, but also cover the operator's cost and cover the growth, and then also have a little bit of money to put in their own pocket, right? So those four things. But you've got to make sure that you're doing something, especially on your first one, in an area where you have some expertise, even if you're not going to be the operator. That's also going to get you points with your lenders.
Yeah, I wanted to just take a few seconds to show you the pitch deck we did for a current customer, show you kind of what that looks like. And Angie, did you raise capital for your company or?
I did. I actually raised a seed round, a $2.5 million round, but then I rejected it at the end and I basically bootstrapped it.
Oh, look at you. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, I went through the whole thing, but, yeah. didn't end up taking the money, which was the best decision I ever made.
I probably, cause I don't think we sold TurboSquid many years later. I just don't think they ever got the return on investment. We're essentially venture capital firms will have 30 in their companies in their portfolio and they'll write off most of them, majority of them. And two or three will be the bamboo shoot kind of all to make up for the rest.
Yeah, I think in my scenario, we just, you know, I couldn't really justify taking the investment because I know the return they were looking for. And I felt like it was just going to be too much pressure on me. And I just thought it was a much better cash flow business, which is what, you know, that's my background. I like money. I like to make money. I don't like to burn it. So I just felt like we had conflicting, we weren't fully aligned.
Yeah. What was your business that you sold?
It's Promota.com. It's a video advertising company that helps YouTube content creators get their video seen. So we started about 10 years ago. So basically customers ranging from like a stay-at-home mom documenting her fitness journey to, you know, Fortune 100 companies. So it started, you know, pretty early when YouTube was, people were just starting to get on YouTube.
Yeah, that's very cool. I mean, the whole YouTube, I don't know if you guys know this, but if you guys know Mr. Beast, everybody knows who Mr. Beast is?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. So he's worldwide, right? But he's very smart. I mean, if you look at his last two or three videos, just go to Mr. Beast, go to his channel, his last couple of videos, within 48 hours, 100 million people will have seen his videos. And his last four videos, more people have seen those videos than all of the channels, like the NBC, CBS, Fox, everybody else combined. It is frankly amazing. This guy is a genius too. He was on Joe Rogan and he said, well, 97% of the planet doesn't speak English. And he goes, okay. And Joe goes, well, I'm just transcribing everything to another language. All his other videos. So this is worldwide. And immediately after he was on Joe Rogan, he had a worldwide event, kind of mini Olympics, from people all over the planet. Anyway, the YouTube stuff is amazing. So this is, oh, by the way, everybody, I want you to, Dutch just joined us. Dutch is my student. We're raising capital for him, $700,000. We created a deck for him. I reached out to all my investors. And Dutch, how would you say the response has been so far? The number of conversations you had, the number of interested people?
I think the response has been phenomenal. And, we've had to tweak the pitch deck a few times, but it's come out to be pretty darn good.
Yeah. So this is it. By the way, you guys are seeing this SD here is a little bit high, but he's got a lot of seller financing at a very low rate. Anyway, we talk about the LOI, the deal of it. Dutch negotiated that. We've done a lot of basic stuff, show the financial report cards, show the financial performance. We actually had an investor said not really interested in the balance sheet. I kind of push back on that and I go, well, it's a small business. Everybody's interested in the balance sheet. Even Warren Buffett's interested in the balance sheet.
Right.
So we pushed back on that. I added some KPIs, strong and validated, some ratios on how the business does. This is about the performance of turning assets to cash flow and how you rate to other HVAC companies. A lot of room for improvement. And we have already talked about that. Competitive advantage. Here's why they like this opportunity. They've been in business for 27 years, and they have 40-plus long-term multi-location maintenance contracts for HVAC. When they started seeing this, we added this like a week into it, 2 weeks into it.
And, yeah.
You know, they were kind of like, we had that there, but then I added the names of the customers. I said, hey, give me the customer list. Who's on the long-term contracts? Arby's, Does anybody know EG's is outside Arizona? Oh, it's a great thing. It's ice and sugar, and it gives you massive headaches if you drink it too fast. Right, Dutch?
Right, yeah.
Desert that's Toyota. Funny. Have you heard of the Desert Museum? Fantastic museum. Blake Slaughterburger. I hate him. Worst burgers ever. Hobby Lobby. Anyway, future story. Right? This is small business. Increase prices. We're also going to decrease costs, add more techs in-house, hire a general manager, manage operations. Long term. Get this one done. He's going to buy another one.
Yep.
Who we are. Here's the peer-to-peer that I talked about. Plumbing HVAC company, 10 years, 30 years in the industry, sold HVAC company. So Dutch Connor, this is how he closed the LOI because he was selling to a peer, and this is how he's going to get investors to do this. So,
correct.
And this is the $700,000 we need, participating preferred, liquidation preferred, and principal, which is the step up multiplier. Anyway,
I missed the top line there. What was the EBITDA on this one, John?
Well, it's not EBITDA on this because it's a small business. We use SDE.
Okay.
Was there a broker?
No,
this is an off-market deal.
Oh, nice.
You know, so let me tell you this about Dutch. Let me stop this share. Dutch put a letter together, hand wrote it, found out who all the HVAC companies in Tucson world were, wrote this letter in handwriting, not typed, handwriting. And it's probably one paragraph, and he mailed out to 176 HVAC companies. 10 responses, 2 face-to-faces, 1 LOI sign.
Nice.
Yep. That was within that 30-day period, so.
Yeah.
And I targeted businesses for 10 years and older.
Yeah. By the way, so anything over 10 years, they have more of a propensity to want to sell, right? Death, disinterested, divorce. All right, so yeah, that's Dutch. Can you tell a little? Just I'm asking, using Dutch as like my, testimonial here. What the process have been about? Like me talking to you about the process of raising money and teaching you a lot of stuff. How do you think that's gone?
Well, it's gone great, and I've learned a lot. This is my first time raising capital, and John has taught me a lot. I've learned a lot in the process. And I've talked to a lot of people already. So we're working on getting the financing together, and it's going to come together exactly at the right time. So
yeah.
John has been phenomenal at putting the deck together and also with helping me, learn what I'm doing because I didn't know anything about fundraising. So, and that's a major part of buying these businesses is the fundraising. So, and it's something that can hold a lot of people back.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you could, there's a couple avatars, right? You're Gen Xer, millennial, or baby boomers, whatever the category you're in, he goes, but I'd love to buy this $3, $5 million business. Where do I get $500,000 down? Right? My wife's not going to let me do that. She's going to divorce me if I do. Right? I'm not going to use the equity in the house, the HELOC, all the other stuff, right? Or sign a personal guarantee. So you got to figure out how to find the money. And there's a ton of high net worth individuals out there that want to put their money back into Main Street businesses, blue collar, boring, cash flowing businesses.
Yep.
So let me ask you about the pitch deck there, John and Dutch. So understand how high net worth individuals' time is of essence because they just want to look at show me the numbers and let me see, if I'm interested or not most of the time. So do you do SWOT analysis in your deck? And how much do you put into your deck to where it's not it has enough information, but it's not too long where they won't say, oh, I don't have time for
you know, this. If I keep it like 13 pages and I'm just going to give them the, here's what Warren Buffett always asked for. And I've got this letter in the course, is he asked for 2 to 3 years of financials and a balance sheet, two balance sheets, same date, 12 months apart. So this is where you can tell trends on the business. That's it. And then you got to tell the story about what you're going to do, the future story. And are you the person that can steward this business? Mm-hmm. Right? And then you got to tell them what you're asking for. I'm asking for $700,000. And here's what, you know, 8 to 12% coupon, some liquidation preferences, which is that freaking 1.5 multiplier.
Yeah.
Your money's worth a little bit more so I can close it.
Right.
But isn't this the second step? I mean, the first step was that one pager to see if they're even interested. They're saying, you know, for a guy who's busy and he's going, oh, okay, yeah, this looks good. Send me the pitch deck.
I mean, well, the first page step is some bullet points about, hey, I've got a self-funded searcher seeking $700,000 in equity to close it under LOI. Here's the top line from 2021, 2022. Here's the bottom line SDE from 2023. No debt. It's been in years, 27 years in business and seeking investors. Right. And that's
right. So the busy guy is going to look at the bait, and if he likes the bait, then he's going to make the time for, you know, reading the 13 pager.
Yeah. Some of them will go, yeah, send me more information. You send them the deck. Some of them will have a five page critique about your deck.
Yeah. We've got a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's it. I mean, does anybody have any other open questions? What that looks like? And do you have any deals that you're looking at right now? And what kind of companies you looking
at? Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like I looked at a coaching business last week, fitness business. I have two fitness businesses that I'm looking at. I'm actually quickly shying away from them. Just because I just don't like the way they look. They depend too much on the existing face of the business. Yeah. And truthfully, in the two businesses that I've seen, neither one could tell me a good reason why they were leaving. So after 3 years, it just begs to the question of, is the customer acquisition just too tough, right? So for me, it just wasn't. They don't seem like businesses that I like. I'm really approaching this more from a perspective of, what is a business that I feel like I can grow? So I think more from, can I build the sales team? Do I understand the product? I'm a big numbers person, right? So I am definitely looking for, margin expansion. But I think of it more, so in terms of industry, I don't have one specifically. Generally looking at business services, though, because those types of businesses fit more of the criteria of, like, can I understand it and can I grow it, right? Can I build a sales team and can I figure out a way to go out and get those companies?
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I am. But I think that the big hurdle I'm having right now is, like, what I introduced as my original question, which is, how do I see some of these bigger deals? So I'm talking to one of the brokers that does these, like, online type businesses, and I'm just starting to start building some more relationships, and I have some previous relationships from people who pitched me to sell my business, but quite frankly just was not generally impressed with the broker model, right? So now thinking about, how do I go out and do a proprietary search, right? Either starting to develop relationships locally. Now I live in Oregon, so that's the other thing. So I am, you know, as much as I love a business that's I can do it from anywhere, I am kind of tied to the Pacific Northwest right now.
Yeah. That's his hat, so, right? Pacific Northwest hat.
I'm industry agnostic, but I have, like, things that I'm looking for in terms of the kind of business. And I am trying to hone in and develop a more discrete hypothesis. Or thesis.
Yeah, and I tell all my students that like that, you know, they're so blinders on looking for a specific business. I said, look, you know, how many types of businesses does Warren Buffett has, right? Diamonds, insurance, Dairy Queen, chocolate. It's a business he can understand and he can help, right? And that's the kind of businesses you should look for. Like, yeah. Dutch has specific industry in HVAC. He may be locked to that, but that's okay, right? Because HVAC in Arizona is always going to be here.
I quick question, John, about that. I mean, looking at the service-based business, I mean, how hard it is to understand those business, you know, frankly, you know. My background has been in IT and also real estate. So even if I don't understand it, I mean, I can hire somebody that can actually, you know, teach me this stuff for a good 6 months and I can actually understand that. So is it really necessary to kind of understanding the business, like, really understanding the business, or is it all about the who, not the how?
Well, if I unpack that answer and you buy a small business, you're likely going to be working in the business for a while,
right?
Because the seller is going to leave at some point, right?
Yeah.
And so you need to have that expertise. You need to know what makes the bell ring, right? And if you're trying to buy an HVAC company, I could tell you, ask Dutch, like, what are the three things that makes the bell ring an HVAC company? He's going to be able to tell you right off the top of his head.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you don't know that, you're going to miss a lot of things.
But I'll tell you one thing that all the business needs, sales and marketing.
Well, yeah, it's all high level traffic and conversions.
Right.
So I do have the background.
Right.
Can I answer this the way that I think about things a little bit?
Yeah.
So Mag, is that your name?
Or yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mag. So the way that I always think about looking at a business is I generally start with the P&L, right? Because if you can dig into the P&L, you can try to understand what the drivers of that business are, right? So I think that's sort of the like what. And then if you delve deeper into that P&L and you really try to understand the who, right? Who's driving each of these line items? What is needed? What is not? Where is their expansion? Where is there not? And right. I mean, if you don't understand a business, right, you're not going to be able to sell anything, right? You have to first be able to understand what you're looking at. And I think, John, you know, you kind of pointed out earlier, it's like, what is my competitive advantage, right? Like, how can I actually grow this, or where can I add value to actually make this thing do something? But I do think it's really critical to understand those numbers and not just the numbers, right? Not just like, oh, can this thing grow? But like, what are each of these things and why is this needed in the business, right? And then you get to the who.
Yeah. Right.
It's like, because don't forget you're on a spectrum between personality and system, right? And so if you're at the system level, you can just crunch the numbers and everything is more or less, you can understandable. But with the closer you are to the personality side of the problem, and we're looking for that sweet spot somewhere in the middle, right? The closer you are to the personality side, the more likely there are factors there that don't show up on your numbers. There are factors there that can destroy your company. I mean, the worst thing for us micro acquisition type guys is that we buy the wrong type of company because we didn't understand what the secret was, or the secret sauce, or the secret that they're hiding from you as to why they're really selling, and you know, what's really going on in their local market, or what's really happening in their company, that there is some sort of toxic, you know, whatever. And you just don't know that because it just doesn't show up on the numbers. And so if you understand the industry and you can ring the bell, you know what rings the bell like Dutch does, then you know what questions to ask when you're talking to them and when you're negotiating with them. Because the worst thing to do is buy a company that you don't really know the guts of, end up having to operate it, and then losing all your money because it goes under. Mm-hmm. That's a real danger in our industry.
Yeah, and I would support what Anjit said about the numbers. Like, the language of business is accounting, right? And you've got to understand the income statement. The income statement is tells you like over month to month, but I'll tell you this, the number on the bottom line, the net income EBITDA, it's a theory, right? That number doesn't tell you everything about the business. You'll learn more, a lot more from the balance sheet, like what it costs to turn assets to cash flow. Mm-hmm. And my advice is just like start boning up on, you know, accounting, learning balance sheets, learning cash flow statements, learning income statements.
Yeah.
And how well a business, if I look at this business, and this will happen for you. If you look at 10 HVAC companies, you'll see somebody that stands out and it's very effective, productive, efficient about turning assets to cash flow. Their numbers are higher. Like, well, how do they do it? And then you can go compare them to them. And that's where your arbitration, your opportunity is, right? Can I do that with these other businesses and get maybe a lower multiple?
Gotcha.
And how many small businesses don't have clean financials or financials that don't match their tax returns?
A lot.
Or, you know, and yeah, so,
I'll tell you, Dave and I are working on trying to buy a manufacturing company in California. And their chart of accounts and their cost of goods is in the general and administrative expenses. They don't have any idea. They don't use first in, first out, last in, first out. They don't really have a good sense of what they're spending on this raw material.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. That's way dangerous. He's very, very profitable, which gives him a little cushion and leeway, but because he sells it for a lot more than it costs him to build. But we'd still like to figure that out, right? Maybe there's some skeletons in
there. There's always skeletons.
There's always skeletons in there.
Right.
That's why I say, ideally, the numbers will tell you everything. But in reality, because of where we're focused, you gotta look for those skeletons in the closet. You got to know what to look for. You got to know what to ask.
Yeah.
You got to know who to ask. It's not just the owner either. At some point, you got to talk to the individuals. You know, once you get that far after LOI and so on, you got to talk to some of the key individuals, find out if they're staying, find out if they're going, what's happening, and look for those skeletons in the closet. Because if you don't find them, they'll come out and haunt you, you know, and maybe destroy your business.
There's always a skeleton.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Thank you. Thank you. Something.
All right. Hey, did that help everybody?
Yeah.
You understand? Monday,
I'm going to bring a P&L for you, John.
Okay, cool. Happy to have it. Yeah. So, all right. So if anybody wants to do it myself, go ahead and get the course. If anybody wants help for the next 3 months to raise capital and start putting deals out to these investors and building this, that's at that link too. So, and be happy to work on you because this is something I did. By the way, I do want to say this. Never, ever fall in love with investors. Like, never fall in love with a deal. Don't fall in love with any specific investor. Don't go, oh, this guy, he said he'd commit to it. Keep going. Find another investor because they will have some reason to back out. It just always happens. Oh, government shutdown. Oh, my stock went down, you know, 50%. Oh, crypto tank. Oh, whatever it is.
So at what point do you have to be exclusive to your lender? At the point he puts the money in the bank, I suppose.
They'll make a commitment, put the money in the bank, and if it's the money's in the bank, right? You got it.
Or into escrow, or when you have the loan document signed, you know, now
it's under legal obligation. Go to some middle party like escrow, so.
Okay, but until you have actually loan documents signed, you just keep looking, keep
looking, the bushes. Right?
Yeah.
Best alternative advantage. Yeah.
I would say multiple investors too. I mean, you don't want any one investor taking the majority of the pot. So
yeah, I mean, with like Dutch's case, I mean, it's unlikely somebody's going to put $700,000 in. We're not talking to VCs that could write those checks. We're talking to high net worth individuals that could put 50, 150, 250.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're looking for equity, right? I what would the equity split look like, though? I mean, is it 80-20 or?
So the equity split on this one, it ended up being a little bit more than I wanted, but still, if I hold the majority, then it'd be okay. So, but what happens is you just end up buying those smaller ones back as you go, and you're building right. that up, building that equity back to you, bringing it back to you, you know, that's my intention.
Dutch is talking about, you know, in some places they call it the Texas shootout, call put options. You could have that in your arrangement with the investor 3 to 5 years and say, hey, I can buy you out, you can buy me out, right? Fair market value. But if they get liquidation preferences, 1.25 or 1.5 multiplier, might be a little bit more.
Right. Then you can stretch it out to five between what I've learned between 5 and 7 years before they can do that. You really, the call and put I've learned is not really the best way to go, because at any point they can call you and, well, I mean, after that.
Well, period. After a certain period, you always put a certain period.
And then you're just like on the hook, you got to pay them back. So you don't want to be stuck in that position.
Well,
whereas you have terms already set that this is what you're going to do between at the 5 year mark or 7 year mark or whatever is determined and negotiated, then that way you can, you know exactly what you're getting and doing.
Yeah.
So
great. Anybody else have anything? You're trying to figure out questions, ready to go. You guys know how to get in touch with me. You got a link if you're ready to do this. Let's start working together.
Hey, John.
Yes.
Hey, sorry, I couldn't be more active. I'm driving, but I'm listening to you guys. I just want to say thanks for the invite. It's been helpful. I'm going to go back through and review some items in the course as well. And I'm guessing this will be uploaded in the Facebook group as well.
It will.
Because some of the parts that cut out on me while I was driving.
Yeah, well, don't get in a wreck.
Oh, no. No, I got you on Bluetooth in my ear. I'm not watching.
Okay. Just listening. All right. All right. Thank you so much for showing up, everybody.
Thank you for the forum.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.